Welcome to International Tax Bites, a series of conversations around issues and concepts in international taxation. I'm Graham Jackson, and I'm a Gibraltar and English solicitor with Hassan's International Law Firm in Gibraltar. Today, I will be speaking to my podcast partner, Harriet Brown, who is a Jersey advocate and English barrister with Old Square Tax Chambers in London. So, Harriet.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm in Gibraltar.
You are? This is really weird.
It is.
Because long-suffering listeners will be hearing us in stereo for the first time in about 3 years.
Hurrah. Yeah. Thank you for bearing with us.
Because I can't work how to get Zoom to do a stereo recording.
If anybody knows how, do let us know. Drop us a line on the LinkedIn page.
Yeah. So we're here today and we're face-to-face, but only the second time.
That's right.
And we're going to have a discussion about a recently published OECD taxation working paper.
Paper number 67 on the effective tax rate of multinational enterprises, : new evidence on global low-taxed profits.
Right. And this is not about tax havens or low-tax jurisdictions or whatever.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it is sort of about them in the way that it's not about them.
Yeah, that will become clear, that statement, in a moment.
And so, first of all, I think before we do get into the meat of this, it's important to say that on the second page of this document, there is a warning which reads, OECD working papers should not be reported as representing the official views of the OECD or of its member countries. The opinions expressed and arguments employed are those of the authors.
Right, so this is not the OECD saying this.
No, but I do notice it has been reported as that.
And it's covered in their logo, right, which is, that's a lawyer's disclaimer, isn't it? Right, yeah. So what's the aim of the report, Harriet?
So the report looks at effective tax rates of most of the data comes from country by country reporting. And we will mention briefly later how that impacts on the quality of the data, and that is recognised in here. But essentially, it looks at the effective taxation of corporate profits, which is, they say, it's at the centre of an active public and academic debate. I'm not sure the debate's that public.
I mean, or that active. I think everybody, all the academics agree.
Well, isn't consensus nice? What can I say?
Well, they're going to get bigger budgets for the universities, aren't they?
Essentially, what this looks at is where, in what jurisdictions, the lowest effective tax rates of MNEs are found. And there's a bit of a surprising finding.
Right. Okay. Surprise me.
So the really surprising finding is that while you have these jurisdictions, these high tax jurisdictions, with average effective rates of over 15%, they still account for 53.2% of that amount of profit being taxed at below 15%.
Right, okay. So the whole of their economy, so this is, let's imagine a jurisdiction that has a headline rate of 30% for corporates, and the whole of its corporate economy is taxed on average more than 15%.
Yes.
But of jurisdictions that look like that, more than half of the global income which is taxed at less than 15%
is found in those jurisdictions.
So what we're saying is there are what a layman might call a loophole.
Yes.
And what we might describe as the effective operation of the legislative regime.
I would really need to understand the precise nature of the provision that we're describing. But yeah. Yes, possibly.
Yeah. So I mean, let's put it. You know, the quality of this debate sometimes lacks
precision
or intellectual rigor.
Possibly,
I think I once saw the Guardian try and claim that deductions for expenses was a loophole to reduce tax.
Yeah, I mean that's an extreme view of what constitutes a loophole.
Yeah, so we're definitely not on the loophole spectrum. We're definitely not with the Guardian.
Probably not by the sounds of it, no.
International Tax Bites takes yet another radical position. OK, so
This is surprising because it's generally the higher tax jurisdictions or the jurisdictions with the higher tax rates that are banging the drum against smaller, lower tax jurisdictions.
Yes, and saying you're taking our tax and that's not fair.
Right, okay, when actually
they're taking their own tax.
It either. Yeah. Yeah, so I think it is a little bit surprising, isn't it? But is it... So the sort of... You get this sort of idea that there's the perception of the those that want to eliminate tax avoidance and lift effective tax rates to 15% sort of don't get that the headline rate is only half the story, right?
Well, quite, yes.
The headline rate is the amount that you are taxed on after all the things the government allows you to take off are taken off, right?
Yes.
So half of the it's only half of the legislative process.
Probably less than half.
Yeah. Certainly in time-wise, because you can change a rate with the stroke of a pen, but you've got to build a whole new act if you want to.
Theoretically, you have to think quite hard about how to draft new provisions, but only theoretically from recent legislation.
Right, okay. You do realise if you keep saying that, you're never going to get asked to draft any legislation.
I think it's a relatively remote opportunity anyway. But that being said, if anyone listens needs legislation drafting, I'm really good at drafting.
Yeah, but she's deliberately trying to alienate the large jurisdictions of my instructor. So it's, yes, the international provisions at the moment seem to be trying to move to close the gap between effective tax rate and headline rate.
That's exactly what they're seeking to do, yes.
But it turns out that the people that are actually doing that, they're actually creating that gap, are the politicians, right?
That would be my analysis, yes.
Because they keep bringing in provisions.
Well, if you look at, say, for example, you look at the recent UK autumn statement, there was a lot in there for business, wasn't there? For whatever political reason, which we don't need to go into. And you could say that may well, for sort of large MNEs, have the effect that their effective tax rate comes down in the UK because they may be able to utilise greater sort of reliefs, deductions, etc.
And do you think there's... So I think that the thing that's probably the most surprising for me is not that there is a gap between the effective tax rate and the headline rate in a country like, say, UK.
Yeah, which we know.
And it has, because it has this, it's not just we will tax you on all your profits
at X percent.
X percent. There are provisions which are deliberately designed to help to lower the effective tax rate.
In certain circumstances. Yeah.
But the thing I think that surprises me is that those provisions don't apply across the board, seemingly. They seem to be more effective for MNEs than they do for our proverbial corner shop.
So, look, I think there are two reasons for that. One is that MNEs, the UK tax code, for example, is hugely complex and hugely lengthy. If you are a corner shop or even a medium-sized enterprise, you may not have access to the expertise to cover that whole tax code and to find all of the provisions that might apply to you. So there's that. Secondly, MNEs might be better placed to adjust their business. So if they're sort of skirting the edges of a relief or a deduction, they may well be better placed to adjust their business approach so that they can receive it. I'm thinking about things like where you get additional deductions or relief for investment in certain sectors or in sort of young companies, things like that. So enterprise investment relief type things. So that's a possibility. But I do think that the ability to access advice, particularly where you have these really long tax codes, is probably an element.
Yeah. They've just got more money to spend on advisors.
I mean, it would be interesting, wouldn't it, to see whether the money spent is worth the tax saved.
Yeah, that would be quite cool to see a graph that compares those two things.
So maybe the people who are really causing the problem are the advisors.
No, the advisors are great. Not all of them, but the two in this room are. So do we want to go into the report in a bit more detail?
It is interesting, so I think it would be worth doing. So first of all, it explains how it calculates the average effective tax rate, and it notes that the data that it's used comes from country-by-country reporting. Now, an important thing to remember there is that in order to be within country-by-country reporting, you have to have a revenue above 750 million euros. So this is data from very, very wealthy companies, but it's important to remember that it's therefore limited to a certain sector. And what we might see if such an analysis were possible more broadly is an interesting question.
So where are they getting the comparative data from that gives them
the average effect?
The average country's effective rate. The country's average effective rate.
So the way that they calculate the average rate is in paragraph 11. So they're estimated in three steps. They take the CBC data and they adjust the tax base for average losses in a jurisdiction and correct for potential double counting of profits. I don't know how. Obviously, far cleverer people than I were involved in this. They then go on to estimate bilateral effective tax rates for each jurisdiction. And then they estimate the profit-weighted averages of those effective tax rate at the levels of similar jurisdictions by using the CBC data that they've got, but also with other data, which they don't specify what it is, and something called regression-based imputations to fill gaps in the data. So, I mean, to a certain extent, they make it up.
Yeah, they don't just go and ask HMRC.
No, they make it up in a logical way.
Yeah. Somebody with a massive brain.
Yeah.
And a calculator.
Yeah.
Yeah, right, okay.
So that's how they do that. They then talk for quite a long time about how they prepare the CBC data for usage, and I don't think we need to go into that.
Excel spreadsheet.
They talk about the double counting correction, and again, I don't really want to try and go into that because I'll only humiliate myself. And eventually, after they've set out their methodology in a great deal of detail, they give us some analysis. So the first set of analysis is the average effective tax rates across jurisdictions. This is quite interesting. So the period they were looking at was 2017 to 2020. And what they looked at was the variation in average backward-looking effective tax rates of 222 jurisdictions.
Wow, I didn't even know there was 222 different jurisdictions.
It's extensive, isn't it? And what that's shown is that where you don't reform tax, unsurprisingly, effective tax rates don't tend to vary over time. Where you have larger changes, you will get a different effective rate across the years. I don't think that's particularly controversial or difficult to have a guess at. But what it showed was they looked at the distribution of effective tax rates by jurisdiction groups. Now, the jurisdiction groups that they looked at were divided into income groups,
okay,
with an additional group called investment hubs. The median effective rate in what they call high-income jurisdictions was 16.3%, upper-middle-income jurisdictions 15.1%, and in lower-middle-income jurisdictions it was 20.7%. Low-income jurisdictions, 21.7%.
So the effective rate
goes up as the income goes down.
As the country becomes poorer.
Yeah.
Which leaves less available for investment to drive future growth.
Yes. And so what they say is that effective tax rates are concentrated in low-income tax jurisdictions between the 18% and 28% level. Investment hubs have a particularly low effective tax rate with a median of, do you want to have a guess, Graham?
0.2.
1.6.
Right, okay, so let's just... Investment hubs is the latest neutral phrase for what is a bus a basket of jurisdictions which
let's see if they tell us
aren't tax havens but have generally been called them that a while ago.
Let's see if they tell us who the investment hubs are. I don't think they do, but let's just have a quick check. Oh no, maybe they do. Oh, here we go. Yes, so we've got a table. Income, so yeah, the investment hubs: Anguilla, Bahamas, Guernsey, Barbados, Bermuda, British Virgin Islands, Cayman, Curacao, Cyprus, Gibraltar, Hong Kong, Hungary, Ireland, Isle of Man, Jersey, Liberia, Luxembourg, Malta, Marshall Islands, Mauritius, Netherlands, Puerto Rico, Singapore, Switzerland.
Right, right. Okay.
I don't know. Would you suggest that might be former tax havens?
Yeah. They've rounded up the usual suspects, right?
Most of them, yeah.
So what we're saying is, unsurprisingly, low tax jurisdictions have a low effective tax rate.
A lower median effective tax rate. So this is the average. We're talking about the averages at the moment again. Mm-hmm. So if we then go back, that's the average. And then what they then do is they compare that average to what the CBC participants are actually paying.
Yeah. There's some really odd things on that list, right?
Okay.
Andorra has a high income, but not an investment hub. I'd have put Andorra in investment hub. If Luxembourg is, right?
Well, look, we don't know their criteria, so we don't know their criteria. That's all I can say on that.
And Turks and Caicos are in high income, but not investment hub. Anyway, that's just a slightly odd result that's been given there, but the point is, well, actually, that's going to skew the data.
In what way?
Well, if Turks and Caicos is actually an investment hub.
But is it actually? We don't know what the criteria for investment hubs are.
But, okay, right. But look at that list. Turks and Caicos is normally on that list, not on the same list as Portugal.
More frequently, probably, yeah. Yes.
And this is no insult to Turks and Caicos. USBI is on the high income list. It's not the only list that USBI is on. So they don't tend to appear on the same list as... Liechtenstein's a high-income one, but not an investment hub.
I don't know what you want from me. It's not my paper.
But what I'm trying to say is, if they're saying it's really surprising that high-income, apparently high-tax jurisdictions have actually got low effective tax rates, and then they include Liechtenstein on the list of... But the things that are surprising.
We don't know why they included Liechtenstein on that list.
No, I know, but what I'm suggesting is that Liechtenstein's inclusion will have a practical effect of skewing the data, because when you see the headline and read the article, you think, MNEs are taking advantage of things in France, Spain, Germany to give them an effective tax rate similar to an investment hub. And well, that data's been skewed by the inclusion of low tax jurisdictions. That's all I'm saying.
No, I can see that might be the case. I'm not as certain as you are.
Yeah, I do tend to take bold positions, don't I?
You've been known to.
Yeah. So, that aside, right?
Yeah.
It's giving us an odd result.
It's giving us a possibly unexpected result, which is that, setting aside the investment hubs, your lower ETRs aren't in your lower income countries.
Yeah. So, do we think, and I know you think this because we talked about it just before we started recording, that's essentially, what that's exposing is a misunderstanding which most people have, including us to a certain extent, yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that... Tax is about the effect, is about the headline rate.
What they call the statutory rate.
Yeah, and an entirely efficient tax system there will be no gap between the effective tax rate and the headline rate, what they call the statutory rate.
That's right. And interestingly, what they say here, effective tax rates are on average 6.9% lower than statutory tax rates.
But the statutory tax rate isn't the whole of the tax system.
No, it's a very small part of it. It's your starting point almost, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really.
But so what we're trying to say is that the when the Chancellor stands up and he does things, arcane things to do with startup relief or something.
That we all
like that,
sort of roll our eyes at and go, oh, another bit of the code to look at.
Another paper I've got to read. when he does that, he's doing tax law then. Tax law doesn't finish with the statutory rate and then there's a series of loopholes that need to be closed. There are provisions that they introduce to create effects, and the effect of that is to lower the tax rate for a company that behaves in the way they want it to behave.
Yes.
So we should not be surprised that there's a gap.
No, and in fact, we've probably all been a bit unsophisticated over the years in not necessarily saying, oh, yeah, but what are we really paying?
Yeah.
And we tend to only... One of the things that gets talked a lot about at the minute is the effective tax rate for individuals earning over £100,000 in the UK.
Yeah.
Because you start to lose your allowances and you lose access to certain other benefits. And there's a you get a really high effective tax rate on a certain portion of your income, which means that you may as well not bother earning any more. And we note it then, but I think we don't necessarily think about it when it's going in the other direction.
Yeah. Well, because nobody rushes to complain about something that's in their favour, right?
No, but I mean, maybe this should have been more apparent in the debate to date.
Yeah.
If we're going to be going around shouting about people nicking our taxes.
Yeah, because we're not.
Because it's not necessarily the people you think.
Yeah. Or it's based on, or just like the evidence for the tax being nicked.
Yeah.
Is based on a misunderstanding of how tax actually works.
Yeah.
No country, I don't believe there's a single country in the world that has an average effective tax rate on corporates that is the same as its headline rate.
There is.
Oh.
There are two other, one unsurprising thing and one surprising thing. These average effective tax rates, where there is statutory and effective rates that are identical, that's pretty much just the zero tax jurisdictions. There are a few others, but it's literally usually just the zero tax jurisdictions. The thing that really surprised me is they say effective tax rates exceed statutory tax rates in around 10% of cases.
What?
Effective tax rates exceed statutory tax rates in around 10% of cases. And they say this may be due to limited loss offset in jurisdictions with relatively high shares of losses relative to positive profits.
So we can actually give an example where that would... I mean, if they're taking the rate that they believe should be, or is their benchmark as the rate that would be paid on accounting profits.
Yes.
Yeah. Then the interest limitation rule...
Would
impact that, and,
yes,
and you would end up with a higher rate than would be applicable simply on your profits or losses on your accounts.
Yes, exactly. Yes, so you were in 10% of the cases you are getting an average effective tax rate higher than your statutory tax rate, which is insane, really. But
yeah,
there we go.
So yes, it's very complicated, but I think it's certainly worth us understanding that rates of less than 15%. Are not entirely the impact of low tax jurisdictions.
That certainly would seem to be one conclusion you can draw from this report, and indeed something like that is one of the conclusions that they draw.
So just to say, they're obviously drawing 15% as the dividing line because that's the internationally agreed effective minimum tax rate on multinational enterprises under Pillar 2.
Right? I assume so, yes. They don't explicitly say that anywhere, but
choosing $750 million as your threshold for measuring, choosing 15% as the...
The former also fits in with the data that they have available.
Yeah, yeah. So what this means, effectively, and again, we talked about this before we started recording, that the Chancellor or... finance minister of any country has lost the capacity to do things that he probably assumes that he can.
Well, he can still do them, but that would be that effect would be neutralised by
Pillar two.
Yeah.
So he's tied his hands effectively because he can give the relief,
but
it won't do anything.
It will be overridden.
Yeah. Okay. So is that a loss of sovereignty?
Well, I would say so. And sometimes a loss of sovereignty is worth it. But I think in order to make that assessment, you need to be looking at it as a potential loss of sovereignty. And that's one of the things that has to come into it.
Yeah, it's not talked about like that, is it?
No.
It's talked about, and this is probably because people conceptually think that there shouldn't be a gap between headline and effective rate. It's talked about as a solution to a problem instead of, this is a limitation on our room to behave.
Yes, and of course that could be dangerous, and you can look at it a little bit in comparison to, say, the issues that sort of the less wealthy countries in the EU had when they joined the single currency, because that was detrimental to them in terms of how it played on their economy. And here you might have a jurisdiction that has a really good reason, say, for wanting to give a tax break in relation to, be it by way of relief or deduction, in relation to investment in manufacturing. They really need to get the manufacturing going, say.
Car batteries.
That will be neutralised, potentially.
Yeah, so the...
So tax, there will be less room to use tax to drive, policy.
And behaviours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which...
Probably not a good
thing. We do all the time now, right?
We do, yeah.
It doesn't always have to be in a negative way. I mean, the sugar tax and minimum prices for alcohol and all that. We use economic drivers all the time to change behaviours.
Yeah, and in the reverse. So if we want people to do things, we give them a tax break on it.
When we wanted... Actually, this might be a Gibraltar provision. I can't remember whether you did this in the UK as well. Was there a stamp duty holiday during COVID to keep the property market?
Yes, there were certain changes, yeah.
So that kind of thing, is that a tax loophole or is that just tax policy?
That's tax policy being used to drive behaviour.
Exactly. But the problem, or one of the problems with the Pillar 2 is that opportunity to drive behaviour is removed from local parliaments.
Yes. So look, what the report says about the distribution of effective tax rates intra-jurisdiction, so within that jurisdiction, in their introduction they say, average ETRs are useful in assessing the average tax burden of MNEs in a jurisdiction, but may mask heterogeneity across firms.
I beg your pardon?
Different treatment.
Oh, okay.
you have to read the whole thing and it becomes apparent.
Okay.
So what they say is this heterogeneity within jurisdictions can result from different firm circumstances, but can also come from tax policies that reduce ETRs. These can include patent boxes or R&D tax credits, so similar to the things that I was talking about earlier, which come in higher income countries generally, or tax exemptions or holidays, more commonly used in low income countries. These incentives are frequently targeted at specific sectors, geographic regions, or firm types. These and other design features differentially affect the tax burdens of MNEs with different characteristics. So we tax legal persons, we tax entities differently dependent on what they do.
Right. That's not tax neutral. That's not neutrality, which we're supposed to be striving for, aren't we?
Yes. And
in fact, it's exactly the opposite of neutral.
It is, and we have there is a conflict, don't we, between two things that we want, the ability to affect behaviours using tax and tax neutrality.
Yeah, so tax neutrality, for those that aren't as boring as I am. So tax neutrality is the principle that a tax system, in order to make the economy more efficient, the tax system should be neutral in that it treats everybody the same in order that it does not skew behaviours in one way or another. So the economist wants the economy to be efficient.
Yes.
The politician wants to get people to behave in certain ways. But there's a conflict there, isn't there, between the technical efficiency of the economy and we should do something about children's teeth falling out.
100%.
Yeah. So if the economy was entirely efficient or tax was entirely neutral, then it wouldn't attempt to influence people. And we use tax to influence behaviour all the time.
Yes. I mean, if you think about it, the income tax in the UK, I suppose it wasn't introduced to influence. Well, it was introduced to influence behaviour. It was a way to get people to contribute to the war effort in the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah, which they weren't doing.
Yes.
At least...
There was no there was insufficient voluntary contribution, so yeah. They were required to do so.
So I think... that what this does is surprises me that you can use a high in inverted commas tax jurisdiction at least as efficiently to lower your rate below 15%.
Yes.
As you can do a low tax jurisdiction.
Yes, and to a certain extent, I feel like we have been guilty of a little bit being taken in by the spin by the media approach to this, because there's very much over the last 10-15 years been an approach to say, look, these low tax jurisdictions are bad, they're ruining things for us. But when you look at multinational enterprises, you can see that by a small majority, the people ruining it for themselves are the high tax jurisdictions. They're the ones saying, come here, bring jobs, bring business, pay a bit less tax, and then either cynically or accidentally under the cover of pointing the finger at the smaller jurisdictions, they're now saying, and we'll have the tax anyway.
Yeah. So...
To be slightly cynical and negative.
It's never been known before. but I also think that that pillar to approach is going to have... I'm not sure the politicians in the UK and France... actually understand what they've done, because they only see it as an anti-avoidance measure.
I mean, to a certain extent, does it matter? Because Pillar 2 does, in one way, seek to obtain tax neutrality.
Yes, but I don't think politicians want tax neutrality.
No, but maybe they think they do. Or maybe the price of tax neutrality is worth paying. Maybe, I don't know. I'm not a politician for very obvious reasons.
Yeah.
To do with my interpersonal skills.
Okay, so would you say that... is there anything else you want to highlight about the report?
So there's an interesting point about zero tax incentives. And what the report showed was that effectively... where you have zero tax incentives, you get a broader distribution than you do where you don't have zero tax incentives. But zero tax incentives are, of course, not being a zero tax jurisdiction. It's something quite different. It's giving an incentive to a particular or for a particular behaviour within a higher tax environment.
It's like a tax holiday if you build a factory.
Possibly, yes, that's one example. That, I think, is worth highlighting. I'm not going to talk through the methodology on how they calculated M&E effective rates.
Let's not do that.
For the reason that I'm not really capable of doing it. But what they then showed was that M&Es are tending to have a lower effective tax rate than the average.
Across the piece?
Yes.
That goes back to... they've got more advisors.
Possibly. I don't I don't know.
They don't give us any explanation of why that might be.
So in their
saying it's like that.
In their this is an analysis of data. In their conclusion, they say a couple of things that are worth noting. First, they say that while average effective rates vary significantly across jurisdictions, the dispersion of effective rates within a single jurisdiction can be even larger.
Okay.
So that's where you're getting a real skew influencing behaviour. And that is, I think, going to be particularly the case where you have zero tax incentives. They say some jurisdictions with high estimated average rates tax considerable shares of profits at low rates in the estimates, creating low tax profits in high tax jurisdictions. While this profit is often overlooked, we estimate that there is more low tax profit reported in high tax jurisdictions than in low tax jurisdictions. They then say, well, the outcome of this, or what you should do with this information, is look at how you're designing your corporate tax policy. And they include that, the inclusive framework on BEPS to introduce a global minimum tax, and say the relevance of low tax profits in high tax jurisdictions implies that domestic minimum taxes could raise considerable revenue, not only in jurisdictions with low average rates, but also in jurisdictions with average rates above the minimum tax.
So they're taking the position then that it is, the aim is to arrive at 15% or an identical effective rate as the headline rate. Is that what they're taking the position of?
That seems to be their assumption. That's the implication of what they say there, certainly.
So this is surprising.
Mm-hmm.
But then it isn't actually surprising when you understand the tax system as a two-headed beast, incentives and headline rate.
Exactly.
And the incentives are designed to lower the headline rate. But we think that the world is moving away from that model, do we? Certainly the direction of travel in the international organisations.
That's certainly the risk that perhaps hasn't been significantly enough highlighted. But if we all have to charge the same effective rate of tax, then it does leave us less room to offer incentives.
Yeah. So, for example, if we want to encourage... So this is another thing. I always like their examples because they're always negative, right? So they always bring up patent boxes.
Yeah, everyone hates a patent box, right?
Yeah, which sounds like a vile provision that only like somebody who's attempting to steal all your tax base would do, right? But what about a tax incentive to encourage green industries?
Yeah, I mean, of course, tax incentives can be a really positive thing to drive change.
What about enterprise zones? What about...
All really positive things to drive change.
Yeah. So,
I mean, enterprise zones tend to relate to indirect tax primarily, yeah. But yes, they often do have a
lowered rate or something like that. You could do that, couldn't you?
Yeah.
And you know, we only know how it works in the UK. We don't know what
other people do.
Vietnam does.
No.
So, but the point is that tax incentives are not always negative. They can be used to achieve good things.
Yes. Sometimes letting people keep a bit more of their money is more important. Sorry, the outcome of that is more important than getting that chunk of tax.
Yeah. And I think, and you're going to hate me for saying this.
Are we back to source?
No.
Oh, okay, go on.
Morality. I think essentially what their approach does is it privileges the state over the, I don't want to say the individual, but the taxpayer, because it says the state should have the money because the state will spend it wisely, whereas the taxpayer can't be trusted.
Are you saying it's socialism by the back door, Graham?
I'm not saying it's socialism. No, that's not what socialism is. That's a statist approach that Nanny knows best, right?
Yes.
So Nanny should keep the money. And then spending the money is how you create social goods rather than encouraging behaviour by lowering rates.
I'm not, you see, and this is the thing, I'm not sure, I don't know, but I'm not sure that it's ever been framed like that. I think it's more, what do we do about these awful people, the MNEs, the large MNEs, who are nicking all our tax, and it's better in our hands than in their hands.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm 52. I've seen the government a lot in my life, yeah? And I don't think it is better in their hands than ours.
In some ways, I do think, because of the way it's been framed, both in the profession and in the media, this has all been framed as a way to solve a problem, and the problem has become all-encompassing.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure to what extent the knock-on effects outside of that have been considered. I'm not sure. I don't know.
It does feel like the problem is defined as there's a gap between the headline rate and the effective rate, the tax gap.
Yeah.
Somebody must be doing that.
Yes, and it turns out quite often it's the government. People we've democratically elected to represent us.
Yeah, so I think, well, that's that then. We've overturned 10 years of tax consensus.
Well, you know, we always like to be revolutionary, Graham.
We do. So it's not an easy sell, even on LinkedIn, to go on and say...
You're all wrong.
No, but even on LinkedIn, amongst the tax profession, it's not easy to go on and say, actually, I think the government are doing this
hands.
To themselves and it's stupid and to push back against the anti-avoidance narrative.
Well, I'm not... I think pushing back against an anti-avoidance narrative is hard. And... You know, I don't actually have a problem with an anti-avoidance narrative, provided that you're weighing the disbenefit of the avoidance, against the cost of stopping it.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's been done. Not sure, might have been. Yeah. If it has, haven't seen it.
Right. Okay. So we think we've discussed it in some detail, and we've worked out that it's exposed an effect. Which is interesting to understand.
Yes.
Right. Now that, this episode, was two people, well, certainly one of us, that knows nothing about statistics, discussing a paper that's very heavy on statistics.
I have a little bit of statistical ability. What they have done in this paper goes way beyond that.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, neither of us could really understand the underlying stats. And it's important to say that they both, at the outset and then at the end, they do say, look, this is just based on CBC data because that data is quite new. There are still problems with it. This should be the basis for more research, not this is a firm conclusion. But they're saying, look, we think, notwithstanding the gaps in the data, this merits further examination to support how we develop international tax.
Right. OK. So future developments of international tax, which we will undoubtedly talk about.
It might get mentioned.
Right. Okay. So, of course, there's nothing in this podcast that amounts to advice. It's just a conversation between two people talking about tax. And Harriet, nice to have you in Gibraltar. And
thank you.
We'll talk again.